from KUT and KUTX Studios.
Welcome to Stuart Hall in Conversations. I am Ben Carrington. Who was Stuart Hall? Why is he important? And what can his ideas teach us today? In this series, we'll explore the life and work of one of the leading black public intellectuals of his generation and a prominent figure in the emergence of cultural studies. This man is Stuart Hall.
It's that slippery nature of race and ethnicity that Stuart Hall really kind of grappled with.
You know, a lot of the things that Stuart Hall has said, a lot of the work that he's done, it's not necessarily placed in a specific time period because there's that ongoing thread.
He was interested in making sense of things with others, through others.
Through conversations with his former students, colleagues and friends, we'll seek to better understand this groundbreaking writer and academic. This is Stuart Hall in Conversations. Today, I'll talk with the award-winning journalist Suzanne Moore about what it was like to work with Hall on the political magazine Marxism Today in the 1980s and Hall's influence on British politics and the New Left.
You know, he walked it like he talked it. He didn't leave 10 great works. He left, you know, the people who make films, he left people who curate images, he left journalists, he left all these bits. You know, you've got young black filmmakers, you've got old white intellectuals, you've got activists, you've got so many artists.
Suzanne Moore is an award-winning columnist for The Guardian newspaper, whose journalistic work and thinking has been shaped by Hall's ideas. I spoke with her in the summer of 2016 at her home in London. In February 2014, there was an article published in The Guardian entitled "Stuart Hall was a voice for misfits everywhere. That's his real legacy." And the article starts in the following way. "There are people whose reach and generosity is only understood when they go. Stuart Hall was such a man. He was the reason I did cultural studies and went to work at Marxism Today in the 80s. I hardly knew him, but I knew his work well, and it was never just writing to me. Hall's words were political interventions that changed the terms of the debate about what Thatcherism meant and how it could be opposed, about race, about class, about culture. This sounds complicated, but to see him speak was to be overwhelmed by his charisma, his eloquence, his desire to include everybody in a room, his sheer moral force. My God, I remember saying, this man should be in charge of the universe. But then he would sit next to you in some godforsaken canteen at some conference and ask you about your kids." Those words were written by the writer and journalist Suzanne Moore, and I'm with her now, and we're going to have a discussion around Stuart Hall, his ideas, his life, and his legacy. Marxism Today is, you mentioned in that opening, Suzanne. I've actually got a copy of Marxism Today.
Oh, yes, I haven't seen one for some years.
So this is the, it's from October 1988, and it's actually quite an important issue, a Marxism Today special on Britain in the 90s, which is coming out in 1988, so clearly it was trying to kind of predict what was likely to happen. And if I look inside here, there's a number of key theorists and people and politicians and journalists. There's an interview with David Blunkett, who would go on to become, when Labour came to power in 1997, the Education Secretary and then the Home Secretary. There's letters there from Ernesto Laclau, Beatrix Campbell's in here, the well-known writer, activist, journalist. And if I look down the editorial office, there is a Suzanne Moore down there, just underneath the editor, Martin Jakes. So could you tell me a little bit about Marxism Today and this period and Stuart Hall's relationship to this project?
Yeah, I went to Marxism Today. I'd done cultural studies, and I came out of cultural studies obviously knowing the work of Stuart Hall. And I was very excited to get a job at Marxism Today because at that time it seemed to be the locus of lots of new thinking and because of Stuart, I think Stuart actually coined the term Thatcherism and analysed it, not just as an economic project, but as a kind of ideological project, and how it wasn't a sort of false consciousness. He was using a really sophisticated way of understanding how it spoke to different kinds of people. Mm. Whereas I'd say the left, up until that point, we just had just been like, anybody who's a Thatcherite is a kind of idiot, stupid. We don't need to understand it. We need to condemn it. And we come out of the, you know, post the miners' strike and her incredible sort of, he would have called it, you know, hegemonic power, I suppose. Mm. That you had with around Marxism today an understanding that there was a politics going on and there was a culture going on and how they intertwined. And that was really, really interesting to me. So I was wanted to work at Marxism today. Stuart Hall was a hero to me. And then I found myself working for Martin Jakes, who edited Marxism Today, who was very close to Stuart. But Marxism Today as a magazine was Martin's magazine. And it wasn't an easy place to work. It was a way of life. And although I was brought in to do the cultural section, I mean, Martin wasn't... I would have to say, you know, Martin did a fantastic job, but some of the things I was interested in, the culture, feminism, they came second place sometimes. But Stuart always had this capacity to draw people in. I mean, just as a personality. I mean, he remains one of the best speakers I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. He could walk into a room, sit down and speak eloquently for an hour without notes and you wouldn't be bored. I mean, the only other person I've seen speak like that is probably Clinton, actually, in real life. Mm-hmm. Just that ability to feel an audience and to make them, as I said in the piece, to genuinely include people. It was a gift. And part of it was, you know, I'll be honest, I mean, part of it was he looked great. He had that fantastic, he just had a fantastic voice. You knew when Stuart was speaking, but he wasn't a domineering presence. You know, he wasn't like that. So I think I said in that piece as well, he didn't pull rank or status. I was this sort of junior person working there, and I know this sounds crazy, but I was, you know, we'd also come out of that period of intense postmodern theory, and that was meant to sort of somehow replace the left. And I got an interview with Baudrillard, which, you know, for me was a big deal. And I went to Martin Jakes and said, I've got an interview with Baudrillard. He didn't know who that was, so he said, I'll Stuart, and who's going to do it? And I said, me, I'm going to do it. And he said, well, no, I think, no. Everything has to go through Stuart. Like, anything feminist had to go through B, and anything a bit other had to go through Stuart.
When you say B, that's Beatrice Campbell.
B Campbell. Yeah. So I phoned up Stuart and said, I've got an interview with Baudrillard, and Martin says, you have to tell me what to ask him. And he just said, in his way, I'm sure you'll know what to ask him. I mean, that was very Stuart, you know, just giving you that support. You go ahead and do it. It's fine. It'll be fine. And it was a sort of, you know, authority that he could do that, and I could go back to Martin and say, actually, Stuart says I can do the interview with Baudrillard. Of course, when I went there, because I don't have fluent French, it was bloody difficult. but that's what I mean about Stuart's sort of quiet support. If you felt that, you felt that. And I think so many people, I certainly felt at his memorial, who didn't really fit in to certain categories. You know, they weren't political journalists, they weren't necessarily activists, they were a bit of that, some were musicians, some were artists, who big, huge influence in visual arts. But people who didn't necessarily fit came together and they'd all felt some support and inspiration from Stuart. And that's just a huge thing, the kinds of people he was able to pull together. I mean, not many writers, for instance, have that reach into visual culture. You know, he was just a very, very interesting mix of... and he had the John O'Comfrey film.
The Stuart Hall Project?
Yes. I mean, that's a beautiful film. And when Stuart is talking about his love of Miles Davis, God, it really gets you, doesn't it? I mean, you know when people talk of politicians and say, you know, they're kind of blank spaces and they don't have hinterland. Stuart had hinterland, hinterland to spare. And you knew that. You knew you were dealing with somebody who really, really kind of was engaged culturally, political, and politically in every bit of life. And not an intellectual who sort of just sat there with books. Someone absolutely engaged, and I think that was a huge power.
Mm. And so what was it like to be involved with the magazine and the politics of Marxism Today in this period in the 1980s? And how did you come to be involved with them? What was...
Okay. I'd done a cultural studies degree, and I had started a PhD, and I was sort of politically active, and I didn't like the idea that only sort of three people would read my PhD. So I started doing bits of writing, which you would think would be a kind of part, you know, okay thing. But it wasn't, because they said to me, you know, you basically you've got to choose from this distraction. I don't think that would happen now, but it did happen then. So I was doing bits of writing around film and politics, and my PhD supervisor said, you've got to sort of choose somehow. And that was, so I did choose in a way. I kind of decided to write in a more populist way, and I got the job as editor of the back half of the magazine, which was, you know, art, sport, whatever. First thing I did was rename it Culture to insist on that. On the kind of primacy of culture. It was a very intense place to work because, you know, no one did it for money. I was the first person they'd employed who wasn't in the Communist Party. That was a really big deal.
Because the Marxism Today was the official magazine or the official journal of the British Communist Party.
Of the British Communist Party. But at that time, there was a real split in the Communist Party at that time between the Euro-communists, if you like, who... you know, wanted kind of nice festivals and it all to be like Red Bologna, and what we used to call the tankies, the hardcore people who really still support the Soviet system. So that split was real.
Yeah. And so the magazine in some ways was the kind of playing out of that tension. I mean, kind
sometimes,
of like...
I mean, you could, I, as an editor, I could phone up certain well-known people on the left and they'd just start screaming at me. Yeah. Because they thought it was great. They actually thought the tanks should have gone into Prague and all of that stuff, mm-hmm. you know, which for me was, I wasn't coming from that at all. I mean, they were old style communists. I mean, we always had quite a lot of money because a lot of people died and left all their money to the Communist Party who had, you know, done that as an anti-fascist thing. So there was that side of it. Martin came in and he was really pulling the magazine and pulling this this political and cultural project to this new vision of, I guess, communism. And we looked to places very much like the kind of red cities in Italy. And we'd had the GLC, you know, the idea that actually a bit of socialism would be quite fun as well, you know, that you could engage people with music, with art, with painting, with everything, and that it was a sort of festival. We were kind of into that idea, as well as this really quite big sort of structural analysis of what then our conservative government was doing. So there were different sides of it, and we would look, I suppose, following on from the work of Stuart Hall and his colleagues in Birmingham at the Centre for Cultural Studies that they'd set up. We were very interested in popular culture, not just the high culture, but popular culture. So I think in this issue there's something about then the rise of Acid House. We look at something like that and say, well, what does this say about people's desire for collectivity, or what does it say? So I'd say we were pretty outward looking, and where we had the advantage for me is that we weren't the left, but the right thought we were the left, so we could get them sometimes, you know. And also you had more, I mean, we didn't ever pay anyone to write. I could phone up David Hockney and thank you, David Hockney, you know, ask David Hockney to write something for me, and he would. Phone up, I mean, great people, Angela Carter, who's dead now, phone Angela up and ask her to write something. The magazine had a lot of influence for a small little magazine because it was dealing with ideas. And also because at that time, I'd say the official left or the Labour left was just in this kind of oppositional mode. We hate Margaret Thatcher, but nothing was really sort of moving. And when Marxism came along and through people like Robin Murray and his economic argument and Stuart's argument, took apart the kind of components of Thatcherism, tried to understand what we might have to do on the left to counter it. You know, there's the paradox exists that it was such a good analysis. I think it was a really good analysis that we kind of produced the project that became Blair. And people at Marxism Today always used to talk about the project. And I'd never had anyone speak to me about the project before. At the interview, they said to me, yeah, we'd like to give you the job, but we're a bit worried about your commitment to the project. And I said, oh, what project is that then? And they said, revolution. And I went, oh, yeah, that one. Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm into that project. So they talked about the project like that. And then something happened where the project became a different project. And that was the rise of the thinking around Blair, which we didn't like. And there was another Marxism Today issue. But if you look at the names on the magazine of many people who were around the magazine, who had been around the Communist Party, around Marxism Today and around Martin and Stuart, people like Jeff Mongan, Charlie Ledbetter, David Aronovich, they moved right away from that position into the Blair project and into Number 10. It was just crossed over. Which was kind of disturbing for us. It was a little bit like, what's that saying? Be careful what you wish for me. Because I think the analysis had been so acute that when someone sort of ran with it, you were like, whoa. But it quickly kind of became, well, we know what happened with Blair. Mm. But I think Blair did pick up a new Labour, the new Labour understood very well some of the things that Stuart was talking about, which was the appeal to kind of people's aspiration, the appeal to freedom, the appeal to individuality that was so big in the 90s, in advertising, in film and everything, and in the air. Whereas the old left were just talking about struggle, solidarity, collectivity, and those words didn't kind of gel in the same way. Yeah. You know, the Blair appeal was very, yeah, you feed your individual need. And Stuart really got that, I think. Yeah. Stuart really got that.
So it sounds like it must have been an exciting time intellectually. I mean, given these ideas and debates, yeah, and trying to take culture and consumption seriously.
Yeah, it was a really interesting time intellectually, and I miss it. And I miss it in the voice of Stuart because it was a fantastic engagement with what was happening all the time and also very challenging. We would have weekends and, you know, you'd have Eric Hobsbawm slugging it out with, you know, Stuart would be there and Will Hutton would be there, and I remember B. Campbell saying something about the need for a feminist analysis and Hobsbawm just absolutely dismissing it. Stuart didn't come till feminism till pretty late, I have to say. And in some ways, Stuart didn't come till race until quite late in his own work. You know, I mean, that's not me criticising it. It's just the development of his intellectual thought is interesting. You know, he ends up being such a huge person for any black intellectual, but he comes quite late to that, I think, because, you know, in his story he came to England, didn't he, to an England he thought he knew and then felt always slightly outside it, and then still when he went back home it wasn't home and he felt outside all of that stuff. He's very brilliant on that kind of dispossession, I think. But yeah, it was a really interesting time. It was a time when people really, really pushed each other to think. That's how I felt.
And do you think it influenced your own work as a journalist? Because obviously, you know, as you, yeah, in the 90s, you become, you know, one of the major, you know, writers, one of the key journalists yourself in your own right.
Yeah, really, really. I mean, it's a huge influence, that time. I sometimes wish now, when I look at what's happening politically, that we could have another New Times, where we say, where are we at now in terms of the economy, the culture? What is the political response? I mean, for me, the political response, I would like to see Stuart now writing on this kind of populism around Trump, this kind of return to this old left thing around Corbyn. I mean, I think he'd be brilliant at telling
us. So Jeremy Corbyn is the current Labour leader.
Yes, Jeremy Corbyn is the current Labour leader, but he's undergoing a leadership challenge and he seems to be spitting bits of the left. He's a kind of nostalgic figure for many, I think. He represents the old left, but he doesn't seem to be able to move it. But some analysis around his kind of ideology, political ideology, would be good right now. You know, a challenge to him that wasn't just about whether he was a great speaker or a great political leader. It tends now to be about personality, but actually this is much bigger, I think, than what's going on now. It's much bigger than personality. That's like saying that, you know, Trump only exists because of his personality. I mean, there are other forces that can produce Trump. So it would be looking at both things. So, yeah, Stuart... And that time made me want to write both personally and politically, and to merge your experience with your analysis. I think that was a big part of it for me. And also, I think, to not stay in academia, but to try to talk to people. I like that.
It seems to me, in many ways, that the kind of parallels interest me between Hall's intellectual development and your own. So famously, Stuart Hall himself started a PhD but never finished it. But there was a certain degree to which, you know, the Culture Studies project was about kind of trying to nurture and to find organic intellectuals, people who weren't necessarily from privileged backgrounds, who hadn't necessarily gone to kind of Oxford and Cambridge, who had a kind of a real life experience married to a politics, but also the ability to theorise, but not necessarily to theorise in the obtuse academic sense, but to make sense of, you know, everyday existence and to translate that. So
to communicate, to communicate your ideas,
and as a journalist, that's one of the strengths of journalism. Actually, is to write in a way that is accessible.
I mean, the thing about journalism is, you know, it doesn't have to last forever, but it should last. You know, it has to last. Well, it used to have to last till the next day. Now it's online; it only has to last 2 or 3 hours. But if it's a good piece, it will last for longer than that. And it's okay to go in and kind of throw your analysis in there. And yes, he did encourage a different, you know, a different class of people. Yes, you didn't have to be Oxbridge. If you could do it and he thought you could do it, then that was enough, you know. And he wasn't really interested. He just wasn't really very interested in hierarchy and status in the way that some are. And I think when he died, it became apparent that he had genuinely worked in a collaborative way. You know, he walked it like he talked it. He didn't leave 10 great works. He left, you know, the people who make films. He left people who curate images. He left journalists. He left all these bits. But no, he didn't do the kind of the Stuart Hall canon, if you like. But at his memorial, you just saw his huge range. You know, you've got young black filmmakers. You've got old white intellectuals. You've got activists, you've got so many artists. He gave to that culture.
Yeah, I really noticed that. You make a really good point. So earlier in the summer, Houseman's Bookstores sold Stuart Hall's personal library. His wife and partner, Catherine Hall, donated them to Houseman's. And it was really striking to see the range of people that were there. I met a young black British woman who was a photographer, who didn't really know Stuart Hall, the academic, but come to his work through his influence around black visual arts, alongside an old white guy from Central Europe who knew Stuart Hall through his like communist and political work. And I just thought there were very few figures whose work and ideas and whose kind of intellectual impact could affect a young black British female photographer alongside a white male, you know, aging communist from Central Europe. And I think in many ways, Stuart Hall's legacy lives on in the kind of the ways in which the rest of us take forward his ideas, as opposed to like the great book or the kind of like the ways in which an academic intellectual is typically defined.
Definitely. And I think when I say communication, his desire to communicate, I don't think Stuart had this hierarchical vision that it must be writing. I mean, for him, the visual was as important as music, as important as going to your kind of local meeting of the Labour Party, the Green Party, whatever. It, all of it was existing for him. And that is a fantastic legacy. Actually, towards the end of his life, I think the visual culture became ever more important. And he really changed things.
Yeah. And even when he did write, there's a way in which when Stuart Hall is writing, you hear his voice.
Yeah.
So even when he's reduced to the page, it's almost like this little conversation taking place in which you hear his cadence. And in your piece in The Guardian, you have a lovely section towards the end when you talk about the way in which he writes is like a dialogue, and you kind of hear the kind of, and how he was able to relay very complex ideas and on complex topics without reducing that complexity to simplicity, but to enable people to kind of understand them, which is an extraordinarily difficult skill and something which most academics kind of struggle with, because we can talk about complex phenomenon in complex terms, which is a skill in itself, but it's hard to translate then. For Hall, it seemed to be the translation and the accessibility and for it to make sense was always a key component of his intellectual work.
I think that's true. And this point about complexity is really important, because Stuart was always dealing with really complex ideas and understood people to be complex. And therefore, he didn't talk down to people. So he would, when he was talking to you or when he was speaking publicly, he'd say something quite challenging or difficult and go, yeah? And so he'd draw you in. He was always asking you, is that, yeah, is it like that? Do you think it's like that? Do you get this? He didn't, you know, he didn't say, do you get me, like my kids do, but there was an element where he wasn't stating something, he was sort of delivering something, and then there was like an interaction just in the way he spoke, which was really, really unusual, I think. And he wasn't scared of complexity. And I think a lot of people on the left particularly think, oh, when I have to popularise something, I have to kind of dumb it down. I don't think Stuart ever dumbed anything down. He just said, you're equal to me and you will understand this. And then you did. You know, it's like he kind of set the bar fairly high, which was also weirdly inclusive, because you thought, yeah, I'm going to try and understand this. And some of his earlier work is pretty academic. But then when he was speaking, he kind of unpacked it for you. And you thought, yes, I am going to, I'm going to try and get this bit.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of, there was a kind of giving in that he did. I don't know. Because I think a lot of people just try to simplify, as you say, and especially on what we would now call, I suppose, intersectionality, you know, this relationship between class, race and gender. Stuart never, ever pretended that was easy, or that we occupy one position, or that we get each other, or that it can all be sorted out. It was always movement. There's always a movement between these different positions. And, you know, it's quite musical in a way, his sort of sense of movement. So, he gave you a sense of, actually when he was speaking, the fluidity of your possible positions. But at the same time, you'd come back with Stuart, I think, always to this, I mean, people don't like to use this word, but this profound moral core about what was right and what was wrong. And you didn't feel there was much question about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like the way you phrase that. It's almost, as you were speaking, I was thinking about the analogy of someone, almost like a tour guide, like taking you through a complex terrain and checking in, like, yeah,
we're still right here. Yeah.
And, you know, and it, and in a way in which didn't make you feel stupid or that you didn't belong there. And it was quite clear that this is a kind of complex discussion, but you know, the inflection, as you note in your piece, of like, just like, yeah, was a way in which he was trying to make sure that you had understood the argument, even as he was then going to push the argument further.
Yeah, exactly. And it's that pushing bit that was so exciting, because you thought, yeah, I've got this. Yeah, I'm with that. Yeah, I knew that already. And then, bang, something else. Another level of complicated stuff, but you knew to be true. Or you recognised something. Or you just understood something. So there aren't that many people who do that. And there aren't that many people who are just so engaging, you know. And I don't think anyone who saw Stuart Hall speak didn't think, wow, just want you to be in charge of everything. You know, yeah. you've got something going here. I'm sure, I can't believe that, I don't know this, but I can't believe he wasn't offered all sorts of things in his life that he chose not to do. He chose to work in the way that he did.
Yeah. He phrased it nicely in one of his essays. He referred to it as thinking at the limits. So you're always trying to be at the kind of limits of what we do know, what we don't know, and pushing
really
it forward.
Yeah, that's really nice, isn't it? I like that.
And so can I just ask you, I'm guessing you were fairly youngish in the Marxism Today days.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah. And so after that period in the mid to late 1980s, did you still have a relationship with Stuart Hall? Did you see him at times? How well did you say you knew him?
I didn't know him very well. He would just be around at certain conferences. And, you know, he got ill. And he would be just there as a presence. And you were just really aware that Stuart was in the room. And if something was going on that he didn't agree with, he was very, very strong, because you'd sort of be waiting for him to make the intervention, but you knew it wasn't going to be aggressive, but you knew it was going to sort of basically kill the person. Do you know what I mean? He'd just say, oh, that's, I'll just say something here. And he would just kind of, he would always be, what the thing that you said, pushing the argument. So if anyone had a kind of, especially when New Labour came in and they appeared to be, you know, they'd taken power, a success, if you like, in some ways, you know, an electoral success for the left. But there was Stuart saying, this is not what we want. This is not what we meant. They are pursuing actually a continuation of a very kind of right-wing economic agenda, and they're not paying attention to civil liberties, and they're not paying attention to race, and all these things. He would just be pushing it so that no one could be self-satisfied. And if you were at any discussion, he was there. You just thought, well, at some point Stuart is going to just devastate them with some sort of truth, and I don't know what that's going to be, but yeah, it's going to come. So no, I didn't know him well. I would just have little chats with him, and I could see him, you know, as everyone could, getting ill and certain levels of energy fading, but other levels of energy being absolutely always what they were. So, and him and his move really into visual culture became really, really important. And so there was a sense that he kind of placed himself there, and then the influence on. And then again in the 90s, you have all these artists coming up, and people like Isaac Julian, you know, really consolidating some of the work that Stuart, I think, was doing.
Yeah.
That whole generation. And some of his students went to, or people he knew went to the States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What would you say to those who would suggest that Stuart Hall was an important figure and thinker from the 70s, but his ideas don't translate into today's politics, that, you know, he was locked into a particular period? I mean, that's sometimes a criticism that's made, that tries to say, well, maybe the discussions around police and the crisis and the work that comes out of the Birmingham Centre for Contemporary Studies was important for that moment in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Maybe this discussion around New Times, which we've just been looking at, and that was important for the mid-80s, but, you know, 10, 15, 20 years on, you know, his work and his ideas can't help us to understand the current conjuncture. What would you say to that position?
Both those things are right. I mean, Stuart's work was always located, you know, in Police in the Crisis. It was about particular things. But I would argue that the bigger analysis pretty much holds up now. I haven't read Police in the Crisis for a long time, but I can't help but think that I probably should, because when I see what's happening with police brutality in America, I can't help but think that there's something in there that would still be speaking to us. The New Times analysis, I think it was, again, of its time, and actually we need another one now. So it's not that it doesn't hold up. I think it just, his analysis was always something that you had to keep thinking about. So he would now, if he were here now, he would be thinking about exactly what's happening today after Brexit, exactly what's happening today. But he would probably go back to his, as I say, to some of his core principles, which are, you know, very strong around inequality. And he more and more, I think, voiced the nature of dispossession and understood, really, I think he was one of the people who absolutely understood in his soul this refugee crisis, because he always really cared about people who didn't have a home and didn't have a place. And now we've got this absolutely massive exodus of people. I think Stuart became more and more concerned and would be extremely concerned now and would understand very well the discourses around that. So, yeah, some of his analysis is located in its time, but it's adhering to basic principles about, you know, what humanity is. I mean, he was just the most human person. So he would see this great mass of dispossessed humanity now, people coming out of Syria and so on, and he would identify with them.
Yeah. You have a nice section in your article for The Guardian in which you say that Hall was not one for revolutionary politics. Instead, he was always trying to discuss the circumstances or events that would precipitate change. For that, he used the word conjuncture, which joins together to make the big shifts in consciousness. And so I think that kind of conjunctural analysis is actually maybe one of the things that he does give to us. So it's not so much that you take what he said in the 70s and 80s and you apply it to today, but you look for the kind of the underlying economic, political, social forces and how they come together in particular conjunctions to produce a particular ideology. And I think that's in the sense that kind of, if there is a whole kind of method, it's that conjunctural analysis, which is precisely not to say you can't take what's happening before and apply it to today, but you look for the kind of the underlying shifts in structures. And in many ways, that's the kind of the legacy that he leaves with us.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. He's not a linear thinker. He's forcing you to make connections. And he's forcing us to make connections about what's happening now. And he will go back to historical events, but he's very much of that we have to see what's happening now. We can see these great big social, historical, political forces, economic forces, but we have to see where they're leading us right now. And only in understanding that, I mean, I think this is a big influence of Gramsci, only in understanding this and only really understanding ideology. And he has a very nuanced view of ideology as well, compared to many on the left. Only in understanding that can you kind of begin to challenge it. Because that ultimately is what it's for. You know, not just to understand it, but to change it. But I don't think Stuart Hall thought we could change anything without first really, really getting kind of underneath the surface and seeing what was going on and making these connections. And that was his brilliance, was to connect the social, the political, the economic, and then put all this together and say, this is where we are. And this is maybe, he'd say, maybe, yeah, this is where we go.
Yeah, that was great. Just one final question. If an American is listening to this, or for our American audience, and they might be saying, well, this Stuart Hall fellow, he sounds interesting, you know, born in Jamaica in 1932 and comes to England and gets a Rhodes Scholarship and goes to Oxford and becomes involved with the New Left in the 50s and 60s, alongside people like Raymond Williams and Richard Hoggett and others, and then yourself in the 80s, a number of kind of British intellectuals. Sounds like a nice British story, but does this have any relevance to America? And I'm wondering if you have any kind of just general observations on the extent to which Hall's ideas, his concepts, even his general approach might help us to understand what's happening in the US right now. Now, with obviously the rise of Donald Trump, with the kind of rhetoric that's often taken place within US politics. So, you know, one of Donald Trump's key arguments is about putting the great back into America again, building a wall, keeping out Syrian refugees, keeping out the Mexicans, this kind of reassertion of a certain type of kind of almost like masculinist, the definition of making the US strong again, and perhaps also the rise of kind of Bernie Sanders on the other side and his kind of contestation with Hillary Clinton. So does Stuart Hall's ideas and concepts and approach help us to understand contemporary US politics, do you think?
I think some of them definitely do help us understand what's going on in the States, because he had in all sort of little different bits of his work, he's really analysing populism, and then he also analyses kind of the authoritarian populism, which different politicians have used. I mean, Margaret Thatcher, who he did write a lot about, had that element, and obviously Trump has it. And what the appeal, I think that Hall would, as he always did, wouldn't say what was popular then. What makes something popular now? What is the popular? Who are the people? Who is other? Because that changes. And obviously for Trump, sometimes it's Mexicans, sometimes it's Muslims, sometimes it's women. I mean, but yeah, you know, other. It's very important for Trump, isn't it, to always have this other group that you can take out your kind of vengeance on. And when Hall was writing about how you construct the other as part of a populist politics, that really does still apply now. But I would also say for anyone in America that he never really, you know, he's interested in race, but he's also interested in class. And I think class is still quite a difficult thing to talk about in America. Race is obviously extremely difficult. I mean, there's no question about that. But it's being talked about in some strength, in a way. And I think, again, Stuart would say, but what way is it being talked about and what isn't being talked about? And, you know, probably throw up some brilliant ideas there. But he would be interested in how it interacts with class as well. So he would bring us back to, you know, he would be giving us a cultural as well as a kind of economic analysis of class. And how class plays out around Trump right now is really interesting, because you can see the kind of, as we have in Britain, the de-industrialised parts of the country feeling quite lost and abandoned, and therefore tacking to the right, and what that's about, what how that works.
Yeah, I think that's encapsulated really well in one of Stuart Hall's kind of famous phrases, in which he says that race is the modality in which class is lived. So there's these kind of underlying kind of class dynamics and class structures which are churning, but they often find expression in highly racialized formations and racialized expressions. And so, you know, thinking in US about expressions like white trash, for example, that are clearly racialized, but actually underneath it is actually a class disposition or a class subjectivity. Maybe similar things around Black Lives Matters and the whole range of other kind of politics, which often gets played out in the US in racialized terms. But I think you're right, for Hall, unless there's a class analysis that runs alongside it, then you get yourself locked into a kind of mode of thinking and theorizing, which you separate out these concepts that race is over here and class is over here. And I think, you know, part of his legacy is perhaps always try to think about how they kind of co-articulate.
Yeah, he keeps it all up in the air at the same time. And I think lots of people in Britain sort of bought the idea about America that a black president was enough. Yeah. And maybe people inside America bought that idea too. And clearly, you know, the official politics and what's really happening is just two completely different things. But I think he would be really useful to anyone in the States trying to understand, as you say, you know, that it, race is one part, class is another part, you know, gender is another part, but to not simplify, but to not simplify at a time of such brutality is difficult, but it's necessary. And I think he would keep it complicated or complex because it is complicated. And just because it seems at a kind of crisis point, you don't, as a kind of intellectual, your role is not to dumb it down. Your role is to keep on saying it's complicated, because that's the way that you can challenge on more than one front.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's useful.
Yeah. And I think in many ways you see his legacy being played up by visual artists who are allowed to kind of play with that complexity. Yeah. I mean, I think that's why
visual culture is so powerful. And the film about Stuart Hall, The Stuart Hall Project, is a brilliant introduction if people don't know Stuart Hall, because it's working on so many levels, and you have a real sense of a person. It's visually strong, you know. It's his love of Miles Davis, his that lovely phrase he has when he hears Miles Davis nostalgia for what cannot be. You know, that's such a complicated concept. But as with all his best stuff, you kind of get what he means. You know, it's a brilliant kind of way of talking about some sort of sense of loss. But then you've got Miles Davis. Yeah, so then you've got this kind of compensation, this fantastic music. That's very Stuart, I think, to have a kind of little bit of sadness, a bit of loss, but then to sort of point you into something that probably enhances your life. I think that's very him.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And yourself, finally, do you feel a sense of loss and sadness that Stuart Hall isn't around anymore? But then also as the type of work and ways in which he influenced people does live on. So we do have him.
No, that's... Well, I really miss him. Because right now, I think that we really need some new analysis. A bit like the New Times thing, where someone really says, OK, like, what's happening now? You know, hate crime is on the rise. People feel really lost. I think people sort of want some authoritative voice to tell them what is going on. People do not know what's going on. And, yeah, I personally miss Stuart because I think that he would be pushing us to really think through what's happened and help us to come up with possible ways. Well, you know, he wasn't a politician, but he would push a political analysis that would be useful. But yes, I do think his work lives on, and I think it lives on in ways where cultural analysis is taken seriously. And that's all over the place. You know, it used to be strange if you're a political person to want to write about music or want to write about a festival or want to write about art. And now that's just become something that people do. Not many people do it with the kind of depth, I think, that Stuart probably would like, but it's happening. I still think there's a huge gulf that Stuart pointed up, which was sort of between these different worlds. And I think he was one of the few people, and that's why he remains so significant to me. He's one of those people who could cross over between different worlds. He could be an academic, he could write in a more popular style, he could be in the world of the arts and visual culture, and then he could be in the world of, you know, left political analysis. There are not many people who can move or are allowed to move, and he was sort of kind of quite nimble in that. And I think that he lives on through people who, young people like Gary Young, who have a really fantastic way of both writing journalism about, for instance, works for The Guardian and was in Washington and would describe what's going on politically in America for a British audience largely. But we'll certainly be taking a lot of Stuart's ideas into account in his journalism. So, yeah, I think he does live on. Probably people see it more right now in the visual stuff. But, yeah, I don't think anyone who encountered Stuart Hall doesn't kind of take a bit of him there. And one of my daughters has just finished university, and I took her to the Stuart Hall Foundation, and Gary gave the talk, and she saw the Stuart Hall project, and she said, why didn't I know about this person? I mean, he spoke to her. She's 24. I mean, he does still speak to people. Why didn't I know about this person? I'm going to go and read everything he's done. So, that's good.
Yeah. Suzanne Moore is an award-winning journalist for The Guardian newspaper, whose work and thinking has been shaped by Hall's ideas. I spoke with her in the summer of 2016, at her home in London. Coming up, we'll interview Imani Perry, Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, about Hall's impact on black scholarship in the US and how his ideas help us to better understand social movements like Black Lives Matter and the politics of policing in contemporary America.
You've been listening to Stuart Hall in Conversations, presented by Ben Carrington and produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, with special thanks to Maggie Tate, Anima Ajapong, Jake Perlman, and Todd Callahan. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy. Thanks for listening.